Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The hottest month of June on record was followed by the hottest week ever at the beginning of July, and the warming El Niño weather pattern is only just getting started. That's the message from the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, which said on Monday that the recent records, including a global average temperature of 17.24 degrees Celsius on the 7th of July, came with unprecedented heat in the North Atlantic Ocean and an all-time low for Antarctic sea ice. Here's the head of WMO's World Climate Research Program, Michael Sparrow, with more on the effects of soaring North Atlantic surface temperatures.
You're seeing a marine heat wave of more than 5 degrees C around the United Kingdom, for example. This will have a knock-on effect on ecosystems, on fisheries, etc. You have to remember that the oceans hold a lot more heat than the atmosphere does. And when the oceans are particularly warm, it means that they warm the atmosphere considerably as well.
Just last week, WMO announced the onset of El Niño, characterized by a warming of the Pacific Ocean. Combined with the man-made greenhouse gas effect, the weather pattern is expected to make one of the next 5 years the warmest on record. In Ukraine, several civilians were reportedly killed and injured while receiving humanitarian aid in a Russian attack on the frontline town of Orykiv in the Zaporizhia region, the UN's top official in the country, Denise Brown, said on Monday. Ms. Brown said that a drinking water distribution point installed by UN partners was also destroyed in the attack. She underscored that the people of Orykiv have been living under constant bombardment for many months. Ms. Brown stressed that international humanitarian law is clear. Civilians, civilian infrastructure, and humanitarian assets must be protected. She also insisted on the need to investigate these violations of international law. After 500 days of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the UN official said that civilians need support more than ever and that the UN will continue to help those most in need. The UN has sent a team of 3 experts to Honduras to assist the country with the possible establishment of an international anti-corruption mission. The experts would be deployed on Monday, the UN said. An agreement to work on such a mechanism was reached between the UN and the Honduran government in December last year. Widespread corruption is seen as an aggravating factor for poverty in Honduras, where a third of the population require humanitarian aid. The experts will assess the country's existing national instruments for the fight against corruption and identify necessary reforms. A previous anti-corruption commission backed by the Organization of American States was installed in 2016, but it was not extended in 2020. According to news reports, it had exposed the corruption of a number of officials linked to former President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was extradited to the United States on drug trafficking charges last year. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Lay your hands on the radio! Lay your hands on the radio there in the home!
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while, but I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Well, that's Alex Smith, vintage. Oh, man, oh, man. And he's part of our lineup on Weather on Wednesday, tomorrow, with TUC Radio. So tune in. That's in our second hour. Well, welcome to your lunchtime listening post. I hope you're having a great work day if you're at work, or a great day, period. It's amazing weather today out here. We're record breaker. We're quickly moving in. It's 86 degrees. It's not, I don't know if it's going to be a record breaker, but it's only at the beginning, and the heat index is expected to be about 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Now that's the heat index, which includes the humidity here in Northeast Kansas. So, and we are on the edge of a even more vicious heat dome going all the way to, Palm Springs, or, you know, out there in California and Nevada, Texas. Oh, I always, Texas is getting, they're in a heat dome. Their temperatures are rising higher than that. 118, I believe, in Palm Desert or wherever the hell it's at, where all the rich guys go and gals. So we've got a great lineup. I didn't catch this morning's Democracy Now!, but you got yesterday morning's, which is Monday, start of the week. She puts up a great set of headlines. And then we'll have Counterspin with Janine Jackson, a very interesting one. And then we're hopefully going to be going live with John Grant. I haven't heard from him today. We have not had a green room talk. Normally we do that earlier. So we don't know. We may have to play a replay, TCBH. Either way, we're going to do our best, along with Tristan, who's at the switchboard today. And if you want to call in and just listen or visit in the green room, it's 646-716-8652. You can always do that 5 days a week when we're on air only. Can't guarantee we'll give you any time. We do have a musical medley or a set of classic music in the interim. before we go live in the second hour with John Grant. Thank you for listening. Your lunchtime listening post. On with the news. Thank you.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden declared the U.S.-UK relationship as rock solid as he meets with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in London today ahead of the two-day NATO summit in Vilnius, Lithuania. Over the weekend, Sunak told reporters the U.K. opposes cluster munitions as a signatory to the International Convention banning their use. Biden's decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine has sparked intense criticism, including from the U.N., due to the danger they pose to civilians. We'll have more on cluster munitions after headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky stepping up his campaign for NATO membership. On Friday, he visited Turkey as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan stated Ukraine deserves NATO membership. Zelensky said he hopes to expedite Ukraine's accession to NATO and get clear security guarantees during this week's summit. Meanwhile, President Biden told CNN Sunday Ukraine would not be ready to join the alliance until Russia's invasion, which marked its 500th day Saturday, is over.
I don't think there is unanimity in NATO about whether or not to bring Ukraine into the NATO family now, at this moment.
The UN is urging parties to prioritize global food security and ensure the Black Sea grain deals extended, allowing the continued export of food and fertilizer from Ukrainian ports. Russia's threatened to quit the deal, which is due to expire in a week, July 17th. President Biden said Friday the U.S. has destroyed the last of its arsenal of banned chemical weapons in a claim corroborated by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which took effect in 1997, the U.S. was supposed to have destroyed its vast stockpile of chemical munitions, including the nerve agents VX and sarin, by 2012. U.S. law enforcement agencies continue to stockpile and deploy large quantities of tear gas, a chemical weapon that's banned in warfare. In Texas, the white nationalist gunman who killed 23 people at an El Paso Walmart in 2019 has been sentenced to 90 consecutive life terms after pleading guilty to federal hate crimes and weapons charges. The gunman still faces murder charges in a state trial that could bring him the death penalty. The mass shooting nearly 4 years ago was the deadliest attack on the Latinx community in modern U.S. history. Shortly before the massacre, the shooter published a racist online manifesto echoing President Trump's rhetoric at about an invasion of immigrants crossing the southern border. U.S. climate envoy John Kerry sounding the alarm after scientists reported the Earth logged its fourth hottest days in recorded human history last week.
If you listen to the scientists, which not enough people are, the last week they have described as terrifying and as uncharted territory. When you see the risks of what is happening already with global ice melt, with challenges of fires, of mudslides, the heat, people dying from the level of heat, the quality of air, people are dying around the world, in the millions, by the way, about 8 million people a year die from that.
In Pakistan, authorities report at least 50 people have been killed in floods and landslides since the start of the monsoon season, June 25th. In India, at least 18 people were killed over the weekend as torrential rains swept northern parts of the country. Here in the United States, a massive, slow-moving storm system brought torrential rains to northeastern states Sunday, where officials warned flooding could rival 2011's Hurricane Irene. One person died of drowning in New York's Hudson Valley, which received up to 8 inches of rain. In Tennessee, a panel of federal appeals court judges is allowing a new state law banning gender-affirming care for transgender youth to take effect immediately. The measure had been previously blocked by a lower court following a lawsuit filed by the ACLU on behalf of three families and a doctor. Saturday's ruling marks the first time a federal court has allowed a ban on gender-affirming care to be enforced in the United States. Similar legislation has been blocked by federal courts in Arkansas, Alabama, Florida, Indiana, and Kentucky. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. We'll go to Nashville. In Sudan, nearly 24 people were killed Saturday in military airstrikes in a residential area of Omdurman, Sudan's most populous city. It was one of the deadliest attacks in an urban area since fighting erupted in April between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces. At least 17 other people, including 5 children, were killed in an army air raid in Khartoum last month. The UN's warned Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war, as Egypt is hosting talks in Cairo this week on how to end the violence. The Pentagon says U.S. forces killed at least 10 al-Shabaab fighters in overnight airstrikes in a remote area of Somalia Saturday. Separately, the Pentagon said Sunday a U.S. drone strike killed Islamic State leader Osama al-Mahajir in eastern Syria. U.S. Central Command said in a statement no civilians were killed in the drone strike, but said it was assessing reports of a civilian injury. The claims could not be independently verified. CENTCOM said the U.S. strike was carried out by the same MQ-9 drones that were harassed by Russian military aircraft in separate incidents last week in Syrian airspace. In Mexico, another journalist has been found dead, Luis Martin Sanchez Iniguez, a staff writer for the newspaper La Jornada, had been missing since Wednesday. His body was found Saturday near the city of Tepic in the state of Nayarit. Local officials said his body showed signs of violence with 2 handwritten signs affixed to his corpse, though they didn't reveal what the messages said. The Netherlands government collapsed on Friday after failing to reach an agreement on stricter rules for asylum seekers. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said he's quitting politics but will serve as a caretaker leader until general elections are held in November. His ruling coalition came apart after 2 parties objected to plans by Rutte to restrict the rights of migrants whose asylum claims have already been approved, barring them from reuniting with their children. Rutte has denied those reports. Rights groups have blasted his government for closing government-run asylum centers and for dangerous and unsanitary conditions at existing centers that violate European Union standards. An Afghan U.S. military interpreter who fled Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover 2021 was shot dead last week while working as a Lyft driver in Washington, D.C. 31-year-old Nasrat Ahmadyar had resettled in Virginia with his wife and 4 children, the youngest just 15 months old. A crowdfunding campaign has been set up to help them. A report last year by the group Gig Workers Rising found at least 50 drivers for Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash were killed between 2017 and early 2022. Here in New York, protesters rallied in front of the UN headquarters Friday demanding the release of 62-year-old Palestinian prisoner, writer, and organizer Walid Dacca, who has been in Israeli custody since 1986. Dacca completed his term for the 1984 killing of an Israeli soldier, Moshe Tamam, this year, but he was sentenced to 2 additional years in 2017 for smuggling phone devices into Ketzioth prison. This is organizer Munir Atala speaking at Friday's actions outside the UN.
Walid has developed a rare form of bone marrow cancer, and he has essentially been dealt a death sentence by the Israeli courts by the Israeli prison systems because he's being denied medical care for this life-threatening cancer. And his family has also been denied visitation to see him. He's in a state of crisis, and we call on them to release him immediately. And we're pushing the UN to push the Israeli regime to do so.
President Biden announced new measures Friday to lower health care costs by cracking down on so-called junk insurance plans, which were expanded under the Trump administration, which typically don't cover so-called pre-existing conditions. The proposed rules take aim at short-term plans by limiting their duration to just a few months and mandating they clearly disclose the limits of the coverage provided. And a judge in Oklahoma has dismissed a reparations lawsuit from the last 3 living survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, in which a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood. An estimated 300 Black Americans were killed. The 3 plaintiffs, Leslie Benningfield Randall, Viola Fletcher, and Hughes Van Ellis, all over 100 years old now, could still appeal the ruling. Next month, 109-year-old Viola Fletcher is releasing her memoir, Don't Let Them Bury My Story. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Earth recorded its hottest day ever, July 3rd, with an average global temperature of 17.01 Celsius. The record was broken the next day with 17.18. Common Dreams' Jake Johnson collected international response, including a British scientist calling it a death sentence for people and ecosystems. The same day, Johnson reported IMF estimates that world governments dished out nearly $6 trillion in fossil fuel subsidies in 2020, and those giveaways are expected to grow. At Truthout, Victoria Law wrote about extreme heat's impact on the incarcerated, including people in their 30s dropping dead in prisons with inadequate cooling systems. One source described his cell, "No air gets in and no air escapes." Public Citizen points to House Appropriations Republicans larding spending bills with poison pill riders that fuel the crisis and block alternatives. And a database from the new climate group F-minus reveals how many state lobbyists hired by environmental groups also lobby for fossil fuel companies, entrenching those lobbyists in state capitals with a veneer of respectability, even as public opinion of fossil fuels plummets. Orange skies burning over many parts of the U.S. may not be the rocket's red glare, but they're signs of war nonetheless. The battle is less well understood as a fight between humans and climate change, as one between those who want to forcefully mitigate disastrous impacts and those who want them to continue, for the simple reason that it's making them rich. There is no way to fight climate disruption without fighting climate disruptors. This week on the show. Emily Sanders watched appalled as CNN's Andrew Ross Sorkin interviewed Chevron's Mike Wirth recently, leading her to write How Not to Interview an Oil CEO for Exxon News. She's editorial lead at the Center for Climate Integrity. We'll ask her about that. And when media illustrate pushback against the fossil fuel industry, it generally looks like activists with signs. But there are myriad points of resistance at different levels of community, offering multiple ways forward, but all of them in the same direction. In 2021, HuffPost reporter Alexander Kaufman discussed attempts of local representatives to have a say in building codes and industry's reaction. Democracy Collaborative's Johanna Bozua joined us during 2019's California wildfires and power outages to explain the potential role of public utilities in the climate crisis. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Thayer. A chummy interview of Chevron CEO Mike Wirth by CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin saw the goal of mitigating the devastating harms of climate disruption pitted against the evidently equally important goal of making Wirth more money. Conceding that many people around the world are desperate for an end to the fossil fuels driving the catastrophe, including supposedly Wirth himself, Sorkin added, quote, "At the same time, I think it would be impossible for you not to want your business to grow," close quote. So there's your frame, the life and health of people and the planet on the one hand, endless corporate profiteering on the other. Only question is, how do we balance them? Chevron has caused the most energy-related greenhouse gas emissions in the last several decades. They took in over $35 billion just last year. But when Sorkin gets its head honcho in a chair, he makes jokes about golf and asks the polluter what he makes of climate activists. You won't be surprised to hear that our next guest offered that conversation as exemplar in a recent piece titled How Not to Interview an Oil CEO. Emily Sanders is editorial lead at the Center for Climate Integrity and founder of Exxon News, where that piece appears. She joins us now by phone from Queens. Welcome to Counterspin, Emily Sanders.
Hi, Janine. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, while this friendly chat at something called the Aspen Ideas Festival was especially infuriating. It wasn't unique. Some of the problems with it show up in other media, which is, I guess, what prompted you to write this piece.
Yeah. I mean, mainstream media has had a very hard time connecting climate change to oil companies and their decades of pollution and deception about the harms caused by fossil fuels. And when you see coverage of deadly heat waves and wildfire smoke, for instance, there's often no mention of things like how the major oil companies are still spending millions every year lobbying to delay the transition to renewable energy, or how Chevron, the world's most polluting investor-owned oil company, is currently pouring even more money into increased fossil fuel extraction and production after making record profits last year. So it's also not a coincidence that mainstream media is so far behind on this. The fossil fuel industry has a long history of investing in the media in order to manipulate the conversation about our reliance on oil and gas, what needs to be done about it, and what the obstacles really are to addressing climate change. And that goes back to at least the 80s and 90s when oil companies began placing ads and advertorials, or ads disguised as news editorials, in major outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post that downplayed the reality of climate change. And even today, as we learn from last year's congressional investigations and hearings into the industry's disinformation, companies like Exxon, Chevron, BP, and Shell are still running advertisements that look like articles in the country's biggest news outlets promoting things like algae and so-called natural gas as climate solutions. So they've really used the veil of journalistic credibility to help disguise their misleading and deceptive advertising for quite a while. And we're seeing that not just with advertising, but with some reporters themselves still failing to name the source of climate inaction and still unable or unwilling to recognize and call out disinformation, sometimes even parroting fossil fuel industry framing about how we can't move off oil too quickly or how big oil is working on ways to solve climate change despite that they're causing it, without actually challenging those misconceptions. It's not everyone, and some have gotten better, but it's certainly still a major problem. And I think we saw that last week with this CNBC interview. And what was particularly disorienting about that interview, I think, was just how divorced from reality it felt at this current increasingly dire moment of climate emergency. You know, we have all the evidence now of Chevron's duplicity. And while this interview was happening, millions of the rest of us in the United States were trapped inside because of extreme heat or toxic wildfire smoke. That somehow was just not mentioned at all in the interview. There was no mention of the dozens of communities suing Chevron and other oil companies to hold them accountable, including one lawsuit filed just a week before the interview took place by Multnomah County in Oregon for a heat dome that killed 69 people a couple of years ago. And last year's House Oversight investigation into Big Oil's ongoing disinformation campaigns and their efforts to delay climate action weren't mentioned. So there was so much missing context and so many questions that didn't get asked, so much misinformation that went just completely uncorrected. And unfortunately, that's nothing new, but it's really frustrating and infuriating when you have an actual CEO of one of the world's most polluting and powerful companies sitting in the room, getting treated as if he were a legitimate thought partner who's just trying to balance his business priorities with concerns about the climate. It felt like a real wasted opportunity to hold him and other oil executives to account.
And as you've outlined, we can understand reasons why that doesn't happen. You point to advertising and that long history of advertorials, and then you go even further back and there are interlocking directorates of fossil fuel and corporate media industries. You know, they're on one another's board. So even though we might call for hard-hitting, tough, interrogative reporting, we do understand the pressures that make that unlikely to happen, and the pressures that make it so much more comfortable to have the kind of jokey, you know, aren't we all in this together conversation that we saw between Sorkin and worse. I want to follow up on one point, which is that the least and most our standards have dropped so far, but you would hope that when the person you're talking to straight up lies, you know, we're not talking about industry PR deception, but Worth himself saying things that were false in this conversation and that Sorkin didn't even follow up on.
Yeah. I mean, we heard Worth tell some flat out whoppers. Like he said, the clean energy system is only about 1% built, but actually last year, renewable energy made up 21.5% of total electricity generation in the U.S. And that number could be a lot higher if the oil companies got out of the way. But Sorkin just let that one slide. There were so many other pieces of disinformation and really actually great examples of the many different ways that oil companies lie and mislead in this interview. And I mean, all of those have been exposed in lawsuits, in congressional investigations, journalistic investigations, and academic research. So you would hope that Sorkin would have been prepared to challenge them. And that's, you know, what we really need to see from more journalists going forward.
So you touched on this, but it seems like part of the obfuscation in media is suggesting that various weather events have such multiple complex causes that it's just impossible to link them directly to fossil fuels. And you talked about wildfires, which, of course, there's much on the mind right now. And I know that fossil fuel lobbyists are working furiously to make sure that people do not associate those orange skies with fossil fuel emissions. And I can already see the memes like wildfires cause more pollution than fossil fuels, but you aren't fighting trees. You know, like you can already see the desire to have people disaggregate wildfires and particulates from fossil fuel emissions. So what should we be keeping in mind there?
Well, there's actually a growing field of what's called attribution science, or science that's able to link specific companies' emissions to worsening patterns of extreme weather and even individual weather events. And actually, a recent study published by researchers at the Union of Concerned Scientists found that more than a third of recent wildfires in the western U.S. and Canada can be attributed to 88 specific fossil fuel and cement manufacturing companies. So we're even seeing more and more of the climate lawsuits against big oil citing this type of research as evidence of the damage these companies knowingly caused. Like this last lawsuit in Multnomah County cited scientific studies that said the heat dome would have been virtually impossible without climate change. So these companies can say it's complicated, just like cigarette companies said you couldn't prove smoking caused cancer and that there were so many other potential factors involved. But I think the science overwhelmingly tells us a different story.
Well, you head up the cleverly named Exxon News. I wonder if you could tell us finally what the goals of that project are. What would, as they say, put you out of business?
I think, you know, the goals of that project are to look at the ongoing disinformation that's coming out of the fossil fuel industry, especially so that other journalists and members of the media and anybody else who has the opportunity to challenge an oil executive on a global stage or a national stage can do so armed with the information they need to expose the oil industry for their continuing deception and contributions to the climate crisis.
We've been speaking with Emily Sanders, editorial lead at the Center for Climate Integrity and founder of Exxon News, online at exxonnews.org. Thank you so much, Emily Sanders, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Think of pipelines and coal mines as arenas of the fight over climate policy, but another battlefield rarely in the spotlight is buildings. Buildings account for 40% of all energy consumed in the U.S. and about the same proportion of greenhouse gases produced. There's an obvious social gain in adapting buildings to climate realities. making them not just energy efficient, but future-proofed against predictable weather events. Many cities were working on building codes to reflect that need, until industry groups said, not so fast. Counterspin heard about this largely under-the-radar story in March 2021 from Alexander Kaufman, senior reporter at HuffPost and co-founder of the nonprofit environmental news collaborative Floodlight. After explaining that the International Code Council, or ICC, is a not especially international consortium of industry and government groups that sets baseline model codes for different buildings, Kaufman moved on to what was going on in cities like Minneapolis.
Every 3 years, there is a vote on what is known as the Model Energy Code, the International Energy Conservation Code. And this is a broad set of requirements and mandates around how thick insulation needs to be in certain zones and what kind of windows are best to preserve energy within the building. And every year, there was a relatively low turnout of government voters who would have the final say on what made it into that model code. It was a pretty wonky topic. Few governments were fully aware of their ability to participate. And what happened is that in 2018, two things kind of converged. Both there was this growing frustration with the fact that the last two rounds of codes had made really meager improvements on energy efficiency overall, about 1% each time. And there was the UN's IPCC report, which really laid bare just how little time was left to dramatically slash planet heating emissions and keep climate change within a relatively safe range. And as a result, you had groups like the U.S. Conference of Mayors and other campaign organizations that tried to push a lot of sustainability policies through cities, organize their members, you know, which include virtually every city over 30,000 residents in the U.S., to get together and register eligible city officials to vote in the process that took place in late 2019, which would set the codes that are set to come into effect for 2021. And it was a huge success. Mm-hmm. They had record voter turnout. They had hundreds of new government officials voting in the process and overwhelmingly voting for more aggressive measures to increase energy efficiency. Some of the improvements going up from that 1% improvement the last time around went as high as 14% for some residential buildings. Likewise, they approved new measures that would essentially bring this entire national building code in line with what many cities across the country are already doing to prepare for a low carbon future, you know, requiring the circuitry for electric appliances or electric vehicle chargers be included automatically in buildings because it's much more expensive to add those things after the fact. What ended up happening once the votes were tallied and it became clear that these city officials had successfully improved on the climate readiness of the code, industry groups push back. And those industry groups include the National Association of Home Builders, one of the largest trade groups in the country representing developers and construction companies, and the American Gas Association, which represents gas utilities, which has a lot at stake in the potential transition away from gas heating and cooking. They rallied and first questioned the eligibility of the voters to cast ballots in this election at all. And when it became clear that the voters who did vote were totally eligible under the ICC's rules, they decided instead that they wanted to stem this from ever happening again and proposed that instead this code, the energy code, is put through a separate process known as a standards process, whereby there is no government vote at the end. It's done entirely through these kind of bureaucratic channels where there's no risk that government voters are going to buck with what the industry is comfortable with. And this is ultimately what they succeeded in making happen.
That was reporter Alexander Kaufman recounting an at once inspiring and very frustrating story of how far fossil fuel companies will go to thwart the public will in the effort to harm public health. Of course, at the root, fights over responding to the climate emergency are fights over power and accountability and power. Resistance includes new visions, new models of how we run energy systems. In the fall of 2019, the word unlivable was being used to describe California in the midst of wildfires and power outages. Our guest and others saw at the core not just climate crisis, but a private utility system that's not incentivized to address it. Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative, filled us in on some relevant history of Pacific Gas and Electric.
There's a lot of history that's here in terms of PG&E not investing in its grid for so many years and really putting shareholder profits ahead of the infrastructure that we now have, which has created this concept of the new normal. But it also doesn't have to be. I mean, having these power shutoffs come on again and again, Governor Newsom has even said these are incredibly not surgical. They are doing blanket shutoffs because they're afraid of liability, but they're also not providing the infrastructure that communities need to actually make it through these. So their phone lines are off. You can't get onto their website, and there's only a generator station for every county. And so that's just showing that this is not just them taking precautions. This is them severely mismanaging a situation in which people are losing their power and losing access to maybe life-sustaining medical apparatuses as well.
Well, and you point to history. They aren't just any utility that is being forced to deal with climate disruption. There's more that we should know about the role they've played vis-a-vis climate change, isn't there?
Oh, yes, definitely. And the Energy and Policy Institute had a really important expose. We hear a lot about Exxon New and Shell New on the news, but utilities New too. They were part and parcel to the climate disinformation campaigns that have happened in the past and have sowed disinformation. And PG&E was a part of that as well. So PG&E is not a good actor in this situation. They are the ones that were able to make money off of fossil fuels for so many years and stopping action on climate change for years as well. And now they are paying the price with their own infrastructure that they failed to invest in so that it was ready for the new climate that they had in part given us.
Well, alternatives are not just possible. They are, as you write, waiting. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the idea of public utilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I advocate that PG&E should be transitioned into public ownership because it can eliminate some of those warped incentives that are associated with monopoly investor-owned utilities that operate our energy system. And we can move towards a situation in which a public good is provided by a public service. So by moving to a public institution, we are going to have hopefully a more accountable utility whose shareholders and stockholders are us. It is the people who are living in California and not the shareholders who are hundreds of miles away. You talk a lot about the media. It's been really interesting for me to look at some of the coverage that's been happening around the investors that are circling PG&E right now. They're saying, oh, we'll take it over. These venture capitalists like Paul Singer, who has been in bed with the Koch brothers for years, investing in anti-climate sentiments. And we see the same thing with Berkshire Hathaway, which is another major utility company that has been trying to stop distributed solar across the United States, just the type of resiliency we need for California. But there are other options that are on the table right now, and they're in action. San Francisco just put in a bid to municipalize their area so that they could take back the grid, so that they could be in charge of their own destiny. And similarly, San Jose, one of the biggest cities that PG&E provides service to, is saying, actually, you know what we should do? We should create a cooperative utility so that it is beholden to the people of California, and we're taking over PG&E at the statewide level.
Well, as we discussed when we talked about public banks on this show with Trinity Tran a few weeks ago, the word public isn't like, you know, pixie dust. It doesn't automatically make things work in a better way, but public utilities would have certain, you know, criteria about being democratized, about being decentralized, about being equitable. It's not just a goal, in other words, but a way to get there and who is involved in the process.
Absolutely. It's not a silver bullet, but it does provide us this opportunity to have more recourse. But there is a history of public ownership in the energy sector, but we have the ability to design into that institution things like decentralization, things like equity, things like a democratized system, and build upon what we've seen work in the past and also where we've seen public utilities historically fail. This is a huge opportunity for California to create an energy system that's rooted in climate justice, that's rooted in the realities of the changing climate and how they're going to ensure that they actually are creating a resilient California.
That was Johanna Bozua. We'll end with that idea of not only fighting climate disruptors, but visioning past them as well. We can call on news media to support that effort, but we can't wait for them. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Forevermore, forevermore, the memory. There's a change in the weather, there's a change in the sea, and from now on there'll be a change in me. My walk will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me is gonna be the same. I'll change my long album for a little short flat. I'll even change the number hanging on my flat. Ah, because nobody loves you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes day to day. There'll be some changes, man.
pas temps de faire.
Hi everybody, this Can't Be Happening, the weekly show every Wednesday at 5, hosted by me, Dave Lindorf. Tonight, we're having on as a guest a dear friend and comrade of mine, literary agent and extraordinary progressive fighter for justice, Frances Golden. We'll be talking with her about her latest project, a new book called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And before we go there, I want to just announce that next week at the same time, 5 o'clock, I'll be having on as a guest veteran peace activist and Vietnam War veteran, John Grant, my colleague at the news site This Can't Be Happening that gives this show its name, thiscan'tbehappening.net. And the week after that, on here on PRN, it will be Lynn Washington, another colleague of mine at This Can't Be Happening, who is an extraordinary investigative reporter and dean of African American journalists here in Philadelphia. So come back both weeks. And now let's introduce Frances Golden. Frances, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Thanks for being on, Frances. Well,
the pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Let's get right to it. Tell me about this book that you just edited, and you brought together so many writers, myself included, to write chapters for this book, and it's an extraordinary book published by...
I think its time has come.
Well, tell us a little about it. What was behind it?
Well, I was pretty depressed about what's happening in our country. I could only see that we were moving in the wrong direction. We were moving further to the right in many ways. Women's rights were being trampled. It became harder and harder for people to get an abortion. Victories that have been won were squandered. They even, in North Carolina, they even decided to deny people the right to vote, because they knew that blacks and Hispanics were not going to vote for the Republicans. So the Republican legislatures drafted legislation that made it impossible for people to vote. They moved back 50 years. I just saw us moving in the wrong direction, and I thought we were either going to have fascism or barbarism, to quote radical German women who created that phrase. I felt that mainly people were totally ignorant about what socialism was. They thought it was undemocratic. They thought it would deny them all their rights. They had no clue what socialism could be. And then with the things that happened in Russia and China, they were convinced that this was something that was really very bad, un-American, undemocratic, and terrible. And that's just not the truth. And so I gathered together 31 brilliant minds. Thank you, David, you're one of them, who contributed without getting a penny in return their
Some agent
part.
You are.
Well, you know that we did... The book has three parts. The first part is what is wrong with capitalism. And that has three or four people. And then there are 25 sections dealing with health, education, welfare, you know, every problem that faces us in this country. And the last part is how do we get from here to there? And no one got paid for their work. And Mike and Debbie Smith and I do not collect one penny in royalties. All of the money that this book makes goes to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. So it's a labor of love for all of us. And since it has been recorded in the first launch of the book by C-SPAN, people all over the country are hearing it by the millions, which is certainly helping the sales.
Well, I want to put in a word for Steve Wishnia, too, who did a terrific job of copy editing the articles that are in there, the chapters.
He just decided that he was going to turn academese into the kind of English that not very well-educated students and people who read the daily news would understand. And it made the book very readable. I think that it would not have been as good if we didn't have Steve Wishnia as the editor of this book.
Yeah, it is very well written. Everything is extremely... I want to read a few of the names of the contributors here for people. Paul Street, Angela Davis, Ajuma Baraka, Bill Ayers, Michael Moore, Michael Ratner.
Francis Fox Piven,
that's right. Terry Bisson, Mumia himself, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Absolutely. With Angela Davis. He wrote his piece together with Angela Davis.
Now, it's just extraordinary. I felt very honored to be a part of it.
All right. Well, you did a wonderful job, and I'm so glad you were a part of it.
Well, I would urge all the people listening to this show to go out and pick up a copy of Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. It's a great title. I mean, it's really clearly pulled from the John Lennon song. And it's so important because, as you're saying, we've been so propagandized in this country. The word socialism is used by most people synonymously with communism with a capital C, and it evokes the image of Stalin's Russia and Mao's China, and it just shuts everybody's minds down immediately. So, I mean, when I tell people I'm a socialist, in most polite company, it evokes sort of a quiet gasp. You know, I love to do it because, you know, it should be an ordinary thing to say, and yet we are so propagandized that in this country that most people just assume you're saying you're a Stalinist when you say you're a socialist. Or even a communist. I mean, I like to say I'm a communist because I am, with a small c. I think that the concept of not having any property and having, you know, communal property is a really good idea, and that's part of what real communism is. But it's so corrupted by the idea of, you know, that it's just automatically equated with Stalin's terror and so on.
Exactly.
So this book, what happens with this book, and people should encourage, you know, buy it and then share it, because it's really a matter of getting out there the idea of what socialism really would be.
Exactly.
I have an uncle down in North Carolina who's a rabid right-wing, classic, you know, redneck guy, military lifer, and so on. And he sends me a lot of junk in email, but he listens to me when I write him back because he does like me as a relative. And the last thing he sent me was something that was going around in his circle of email people. Some black woman out in Los Angeles who was saying that she didn't like Obama because he's a communist. And I wrote, his name is Duke. I wrote, Uncle Duke, you know, whenever I hear someone call Obama a communist, I have to laugh. He is so far from anything to do with communism. He's a corporatist. He's a tool of the banking industry and of all the executives in the Fortune 500. I said, if he were a communist, he wouldn't have given us Obamacare. He would have given us Canadian health care. If he were a communist, he would be ending the kind of property tax funded education we have, and he'd do what they have in Finland, as sort of a socialist country, or Sweden, where every school system is equally funded with the same amount of money per student and the same class sizes. There's no poor schools and rich schools in those countries. That would be communism, you know, or socialism. But this book really
does
that.
Don't even realize that, in a sense, Social Security is a socialist concept.
It is, and it was brought to us courtesy of the Socialist Party activists back in the 30s and 20s who were pushing for it.
Exactly.
Which brings me, you know, I don't want to go too far into this discussion without mentioning to people that you actually, you're a long-time socialist. I don't know how far back you became a socialist, but this is a woman who, after she had a serious medical crisis, and I went to see her, I gave her a little gift. And want my listeners to know, I gave you a little music box that a friend had brought back from Poland.
I'll never forget that. I do love it so much.
It's a little red music box that plays the start of the Internationale, and Francis was so happy.
I was, indeed. It's my favorite song in the whole world.
But
I find it absolutely thrilling.
In your house, Francis, you have these wonderful pictures of you campaigning for city council. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, there was once a political organization called the American Labor Party, and I was selected to run for state senate on the American Labor Party. I think it was 1950, and
not an easy time to be a leftist.
And I knew a lot of people, and they thought that I would be a good candidate. And what absolutely shocked me and changed my life is that the head of the ticket of the American Labor Party for U.S. Senate, I was running for state Senate, that the person running for U.S. Senate was Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. And
wow.
I not only met him, but I campaigned with him. And when his secretary went on vacation, I was his secretary for 2 weeks. And people think of Du Bois as something 100 years ago. And they can't believe that I met and worked with this man. It was the most exciting year of my life. And it's when I became a public speaker because I was campaigning. And
you look like you're really letting it fly there on the stage in one of the pictures on your wall.
Right.
In the campaign.
Yes, I was on top of a sound truck on First Avenue and 10th Street. And Du Bois got 10% of the vote, and I got 14% of the vote because I was the only woman on the ticket. And the women in Stuyvesant Town and on the Lower East Side remembered me. Oh, she got me a painting, you know. She got me a rent reduction. So I got 4% more because of the local support. It was very exciting. And for a minority left-wing party to get 14% of the vote is quite impressive.
That wasn't an easy time to be a leftist either, was it, 1950?
No,
that
was
already
it was not.
The Red Scares and stuff starting.
Many of our meetings were attacked by nutcases, but we had friends that were protecting us, so it worked out fine. It was the year that changed my life.
Well, I'm glad it did.
Right.
And by the way, I want to let people know that this is a call-in show, and if you want to call and talk to Frances or ask her a question, the number is 888-874-4888. I'll say that again, 888-874-4888.
Right. So I hope you do call. I want to just tell you a story because it was so fascinating to me. Every year I go to Los Angeles and spend 1 week in a nursing home with my beloved sister who's 3 years older than I am. I'm 89 and she's 92 or 93. And I don't leave her side. I sleep with her. I eat 3 meals a day with her. And for 6 days and 6 nights, I am with my sister. And the people who work there in this nursing home seem to do everything. They feed patients who can't eat by themselves. They sweep the floor. They serve the food. They wash the dishes. They work so hard, and they're so wonderful. And it's a nursing home. The owner owns 5 or 6 similar ones all over California. And people were coming in, and I was autographing books, and we were talking about Imagine living in a socialist USA. And one day, a couple of the people who worked there came in and said, "What is this stuff about socialism? What does it mean to me? What does it mean to me?" And I said, "Do you really want to know?" And they said, "Yes, we really do." And I said, "Who do you think is the best trainer of use of the staff? Who do you think is the best trainer?" And they said, "Oh, Michael, he's the best trainer." "And who do you think knows more about money than anybody else?" And they said the person who does that. And I said, "If you ran this wonderful institution and that man became the trainer and that woman became the financial person, and you worked 6.5 days and one half day of every week, you didn't work, but you sat down and had a meeting about how you were doing and what you could do even better. And at the end of the year, the money that is made, which might be $200,000, maybe you'd give the trainer a little bit more than you get, or maybe the financial person. They said, well, what happens to the rest of the money? And I said, it's yours. It's divided amongst the workers. What you have to understand, that in any factory which makes items, the only person who does nothing constructive is the boss. You can't live without the janitor. You can't live without any of the workers, because they all have a job to do that creates the product. But the boss just takes the money. And if you didn't have a boss and you were all the bosses, the money would be yours. And they said, well, in that case, we're for socialism. And I said, well, think about it. Here's a copy of the book. Read it. You know, if you have any questions, let me know. And it's true that the only thing, the person that doesn't do anything to create, whether it's a nursing home or a tube of toothpaste, is the boss. He's the only one who's expendable.
Fantastic. That really does lay it out nicely. Very simple and directly in front of them.
Exactly. They were very excited about what they understood to be how socialism would affect them. It was a great experience, and I didn't plan it. It just fell into my lap.
Well, all of these people that you asked to write the book, are these all people that you've worked with?
No. Many of them are my clients. A quarter of them are, I represent their books, because I don't have a normal agency. I have an agency that produces books to change the world. It's the only such agency in the country. And we don't hide it. We flaunt it. And so a lot of the people were my clients. And then I worked also with Mike and Debbie Smith, without whom I could not have done this book. And they knew a lot of people I didn't know. And so we filled in, calling all these people, and all of them volunteered their work and did a fabulous job. And that's how the book was pulled together.
One of the exciting things about this book, reader and listeners, is that it's not just a small press publication. It's published by HarperCollins. And Francis, you told a very funny story at the book party releasing this book in Soho that I was at last month, and about HarperCollins publishing the book. I wonder if you could relate that.
Well, of course, when I asked them to do the book, they said, of course not. And I wrote back and I said, what do you mean, of course not? I want you to do this book. And they said, no, the second time. And anyway, they said no three times, and then I wrote them a letter. And I said, you know, I have given you the best fiction writer in the country in the person of Barbara Kingsolver. I have given you a book that has sold next to the Bible more than any other book, called Good Night Moon, because we represent the estate of Margaret Weiss Brown. I said, I have given you some of the best intellectuals, including Mumi Abu-Jamal, and you have once produced a book called The 100 Worst Americans, which included Barbara Kingsolver and another Harper author. It was a vicious anti-liberal book. And you published that piece of shit. And you have the nerve to tell me that you won't publish a book that means so much to me. How dare you? And they wrote back, this was the third letter, and they said, your passion and your persistence has won out. We will do it. And they not only did it, but they did a spectacular job. I got the best possible editor. I got the best PR person. They're working their tails off. And now that it has been recorded and played frequently on C-SPAN, they're very happy that they decided to publish this book because it's going to do very well.
That's a great story.
Yes, it's wonderful.
It's not often that you have an agent put it on the line like that to a publisher.
Yes, really. But they've done a really fine job, and I have nothing but praise for the company and the people that are working with me on this book. They've really been splendid.
So you got that, listeners? Go out and get it. Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. It's available in bookstores. It's available online. It's available all over the place. It's something to give for birthday presents, Christmas presents. And,
graduation presents.
Graduation
presents. Kids
presents.
Are getting
absolutely.
Out of high school.
Absolutely. Bar mitzvahs.
This book. Yes.
Everything.
Exactly.
Give it out. Now we move on. You said that you had three goals in your life that you wanted to achieve, and one of them was this book, so you've done it. What are your
That's
other two?
That's the second one. The first one, my neighborhood was invaded by Robert Moses in 1954, and seven of us formed an organization called the Cooper Square Committee. And that was 54 years ago.
I think the Pope did.
And we took on Robert Moses on two fronts. He said that the people who were living on 3rd and 4th Street on the Lower East Side were living in terrible tenements with toilets in the hall for 9 or 10 people, no sink, just a toilet, bathtubs in the kitchen, no light or air. It was just very bad housing. And they said, we can knock down these buildings and we can put in people who can walk to Wall Street from this block in 20 minutes, because he just walked it and it took him 20 minutes. He said, so we're going to destroy all of this and we're going to build co-ops. And he picked the wrong neighborhood. You don't push people around on the Lower East Side. There's such an incredible legacy of activism and liberalism on the Lower East Side, with the people who came here from all over the world, most of them from oppression. And they built unions, and Emma Goldman and Dubinsky, you know, it was just a hotbed of radicals. And we took on Robert Moses. And first he decided to build a throughway from the Hudson River to the East River, which would have destroyed Little Italy and would have destroyed our plans to rebuild Cooper Square. And so it took us a while, but on both cases, in both the project he wanted to build and the throughway he wanted to build, he was defeated. And when we defeated Robert Moses, we felt like giants. We felt we could do anything. If we can defeat Moses, we can do anything. And it gave us the courage and the energy to fight for 54 years. And we, a few months ago, everybody in Cooper Square, all 300 and something people, bought their apartment, whether it was a studio or a three-bedroom. Each paid exactly $250. They own their apartment, but they cannot sell them. It has to be affordable for the next 198 years.
Wow. That's longer than the lease on Guantanamo.
Yes, it's based on a community land trust, because if you don't have a community land trust, people will get greedy and they will sell their apartment for money. And there were 100 co-ops on the Lower East Side in the 70s by Young Turks who took over buildings. Every one of those 100 co-ops have gone private. Every one of them.
Yeah, you know
but
what happened?
Cooper Square will never go private.
That's
because
fantastic.
We figured out
a way to beat it.
We own the land. The tenants own the building. And if they ever get greedy and decide they want to rent their apartment, sell their apartment, we will tell them, do you have a majority of the tenants? They will say, yes, we have a majority. I said, okay, you own the building. If you want to make a profit on it, we own the land. So take your building elsewhere and sell it for a profit. And they said, how do we take our building elsewhere? That's your problem. We know that this place will be permanently affordable. It's the reason there's gentrification all over the country, because if people become cooperators, they get greedy and they rent their they sell their apartment for a profit.
Well, in fairness, one of the things that, you know, I experienced this when my wife and I lived in New York, and our building, which was owned by one of the landlords that the Village Voice had written up as one of the 10 worst landlords in the city.
Right.
I forget his first name, Katz. But at any rate, he was trying to drive all the tenants out. He was using really, horrible methods for people, like dragging old men down the stairs by their feet with their heads banging on the stairs and stuff. He was a monster. But we organized and fought him. And eventually we got a deal where the tenants who lived there could buy their apartments from him at very low cost. And so most of us were able to stay there. Some of us, like me, we didn't buy, but we couldn't be driven out either. And so the place was co-op. But what I found out happened, and this is another thing that goes on, is that gradually, some of the apartments were sold by the landlord, and they went to, wealthy Wall Street lawyers and the like, mostly Wall Street lawyers. And then those went at market rates. And then gradually those guys would get to be a majority, and they started raising the maintenance fees in the building. Mm-hmm. Because what they would do is they'd say, oh, the lobby looks so tacky. And so they'd redo the lobby with marble. And they'd say, we need a doorman, with a uniform 24 hours a day. So they'd hire a doorman with a uniform. They'd redo the elevators. The worst one, apparently, that drove people out was they said that it was a 17-story building, and they said the water pressure's not good enough in the higher floors. We need to replumb the building. Well, that's hugely expensive. And they also steam cleaned the facade. You know, all those things cost money. And in the end, they raised the maintenance fees, which are uncontrolled, and are voted by the majority, to such a high rate that the people who were artists and musicians and ordinary working class people, they had to leave. It wasn't a matter of greed. They actually had to sell because they couldn't pay the maintenance fees.
Right.
And in the end, the good people were driven out. And they had to sell for what they could get, because they were going to be forced out of the city into, the godforsaken real estate markets in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's happening all over the country.
But you guys figured out a way to beat it. That's fantastic.
Gentrification has taken hold, and it's horrible. It's just you can't afford to live in Manhattan anymore.
No.
No way.
Most cities of the country.
And Brooklyn is coming up fast in the same way. It's all being gentrified.
Well, I'm glad you got that one good story. So what's your third? I know, but I'm going to ask you. What is your third goal?
Well, I'm 89 years old, and so I've won the fight in Cooper Square. My book is in hand, and before I die, Mumia Abu-Jamal is going to be free. That's my last job that I've got to do, and I'm going to do it. I don't have a lot of time. My health is pretty good, but my memory sucks. But that's all of my energy is going to go into it. There are more and more people joining the struggle, and I'm going to die a happy woman, because Mumia is going to be free.
Well, for those of the listeners who don't know, the reason I met Frances is that I wrote a book on the Mumia Abu-Jamal case called Killing Time, which I know Frances likes. And I'm very, very involved in that case myself. In fact, there's an aspect of it I wanted to talk about right now that's going on today. It's a much bigger case than just Mumia, as you will see. But I want to say that on the evidence, Francis, of your achieving victory on your other two goals, both of which were quite awesome challenges, publishing this book and by a major publisher and winning a 54-year battle like that in such grand style, I think that, you know, that Mumia is in good hands with your goal of getting him out of his life in prison without a chance of parole
status. Done with by Francis. It's got to be done by millions of other people who are getting into the struggle.
But he couldn't have a better better person pushing for this goal, I got to say. You are not a woman to tangle with lightly, I think. Well, on this Mumia story, and by the way, let me again announce the number, because we're not getting callers, but I want to get callers here. We're at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888 if you want to ask a question to Frances Golden. That's Frances with an E, as she always tells me. So where Mumia makes the news right now is an interesting story about the venality of politicians and the power of the police labor union or union, let's call it, a lobby, the Fraternal Order of Police. The junior senator of Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, a neo-fascist, Tea Partyite Republican who won election to this first term of his, is he was on a rampage to prevent the nomination by the appointment by President Obama of a new head of the civil justice branch of the civil rights branch, rather, of the Justice Department. And he had named a brilliant lawyer and somebody very experienced in civil rights litigation, Debe Adigbile, who is the supervising attorney for the litigation team at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Right.
All parties were endorsing him as the, you know, in the legal profession, were saying this is a brilliant nomination. This guy is, you know, has the background, has the know-how, has the training to be an extraordinary civil rights unit director. Mm-hmm. And so then
I think Assistant Attorney General.
Pardon?
It's
the rank of Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to a hearing before the – his nomination goes before the Justice – the – I'm sorry, the – yeah, the Justice Committee of the Senate. And and Toomey comes in. And he says, you know, that at the last minute he comes in and saying that he wants to have the widow of Officer Daniel Faulkner, Maureen Faulkner, testify. And the grounds are that that Adigbile had volunteered to help with the appeal of Mumia's case against his, you know, he had his death sentence overturned on constitutional grounds by a federal court here in Philadelphia. And that decision was upheld by a three-judge panel on the Philadelphia District Court of Appeals.
Right.
And then
It went on up to the Supreme Court, which refused to reconsider the case. Therefore, they endorsed the decision of the Third Circuit, and so Mumia was finally, after I think 29 years, finally released from the hellhole of solitary confinement on Pennsylvania's death row, and put into the general prison population.
Right.
So he's no longer in solitary confinement. He can finally hug his grandchildren. He can finally meet most people except for Francis, mm-hmm. who's not being allowed in to see him. But at any rate, it's a big improvement for him, but under the laws of the state, when you have your death penalty lifted, it converts to automatically life in prison without possibility of parole. And
right.
that's something that I think Mumia himself has said is worse than death.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who have that sentence kind of agree. So anyway, Adegbile had, in the position he was in as supervisor of the attorneys in the litigation unit, he had supervised the lawyers who had written their amicus brief and then assisted directly in the appeal of that death sentence,
mm-hmm.
an appeal that was upheld by the Third Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so because he did that, Senator Toomey, clearly in a way of wanting to suck up to the Fraternal Order of Police, who desperately wanted for years to, as they put it, fry Mumia, and who are, you know, want to make his life as miserable as possible ever since they lost the chance to have him executed. He went into that committee and then gave a speech to the Senate floor in which full of falsehoods, in which he said that Adegbile did not deserve to be in the Justice Department in
mm-hmm.
that role that he was nominated for because he had helped with that appeal.
Right.
Most recently, he wrote an op-ed piece in the Inquirer on Monday, which I wrote a letter of response to that will never be published because it's the Inquirer, but it was full of lies, and the biggest lie, and the one that was the most damaging, was he said that Mumia had during the court hearing that the prosecutor had held up the bloody shirt of Officer Faulkner, the man that Mumia was convicted of having killed, murdered, as they convicted him. He held up that shirt, and that Mumia had turned around and smiled, or as he put it, smirked at Faulkner's widow, Maureen Faulkner, who was in the courtroom. The problem is, this is a lie that was perpetrated by Maureen Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
In 1995, 13 years after the trial in 1982, 13 years later, in an interview with a reporter from the actually a profile with a
mm-hmm.
reporter from the Washington Post, Maureen Faulkner told this horrifying story of Mumia, you know, smiling at her as the bloody shirt of her husband was held up. A shirt which Toomey, by the way, said had four bullet holes in it where Mumia, he claimed, had shot him in the chest, and then when he was on the ground, it fired four more bullets at him. Here's the problem. The court, as I had written in my book in 2003, the trial transcript shows that Mumia had been removed at the start of that day's trial by the judge.
He was not in the courtroom.
And he was not in the courtroom when the shirt was held up. So this
mm-hmm.
is either, you know, if you wanted to be charitable, you would say that Maureen Faulkner, who clearly lost her husband and was clearly distressed by it, has manufactured a memory, which
mm-hmm.
many people do.
Right. It's possible she manufactured a memory. It's also possible it's just a blatant lie, because the other part about Maureen Faulkner is that she has, over the years, been a crusade, to have Mumia killed, and now she can't have him killed, so she's on a crusade to make his life miserable, and she's written a book, so, you know, she's profiting off of the, her victimhood. And, you know, I think I feel sorry for her mostly, because I think, you know, she has been manipulated by the FOP, which has an agenda and doesn't give a damn about her, but is, you know, they're on an agenda of trying to, a vindictive agenda against Mumia. But whatever her motives are, it's a factually incorrect thing that she's done. And Toomey, who's nothing but a hack politician, is using that that lie, and successfully, because I think six Democrats, including the other senator in Pennsylvania, Democrat Bob Casey, voted to reject the Edigbili nomination, and his explanation to the media was that Maureen's suffering from having that incident with the shirt turned him against Edigbili. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, it has nothing to do with justice. It has nothing to do with the law. It has to do with the manipulation of people's sentiments and the propagandizing and false, you know, just an example, the Inquirer should never have run Toomey's op-ed piece, because you aren't, you can say whatever opinion you want in an op-ed piece, but you can't make up facts.
Right. But they do it all the time.
Of course they knew it. The Inquirer's covered this case from day one.
I don't know why the movement isn't using it. I know I'm using it every opportunity. They hid the fact at the trial that there were not three people at the scene, but four people. There were four people at the scene. Mumia's brother, Billy, was in the car with a guy named Kenneth Freeman. Kenneth Freeman was Billy's partner. They had a little stand in Philadelphia where they sold chewing gum and
right nearby.
Stuff. Yes. And Freeman was picked out of a lineup by three people who were used by the opposition to speak for them. The two of them were prostitutes, and they picked the killer, and they picked Kenneth Freeman in a lineup. Kenneth Freeman had an afro. Mumia had dreads. They said the person who ran away was wearing an army jacket. Mumia was wearing a sweater.
One of the four supposed eyewitnesses used by the prosecution in the case actually did not identify Mumia at where he was being left to die in the police wagon at the scene for about half an hour. They brought all the witnesses over except for one, and this witness they brought over did not identify him. He's described as an eyewitness by Toomey as an eyewitness who supports the claim that Mumia brutally shot the officer, but in fact, he described the shooter as a man with an afro, and Mumia was wearing dreads.
Stoppy, will you get the bell? I'm on the phone.
Right. So the thing that's so interesting to me is that Kenneth Freeman, who was actually the man who murdered Officer Faulkner, just a minute. They were so frightened that Mr. Freeman would either confess or be found to be the real killer, that the chief of police sent two or three men to his house
This was in 85, right?
Yes, and they broke into his house, and they shoved something in his mouth so he couldn't yell. They tied his hands behind his back with handcuffs, and he woke up. He was buck naked, lying in bed sleeping. He woke up and realized what was happening to him and ran out of the house and ran through the streets with two or three cops with loaded guns following him. And as he was running through a vacant lot, one of the bullets hit him in the back and killed him. And the next day, and they did it that night because the next day is the day that they bombed the MOVE compound.
And burned down a whole block.
And a whole block was burned to smithereens, and they knew that there would be no other news in the papers. There was a two-line article that a crazed, naked man was found running through the streets and was killed by the wonderful police.
To protect the community.
And no one talks about this. Now, the man that they killed is the man who killed Officer Faulkner. And everybody in power, the district attorney, the governor, they all know that this is true. And none of them are saying a word of why they killed Kenneth Freeman, who is the killer of Officer Faulkner. And we're not talking about it except whenever I get an opportunity to be articulate about this case with the media, I tell this story because it's true. And why they're not using it is beyond me. Everybody in power in Philadelphia knows that it's true.
Well, it's true. There's so many lies in this case, Francis, that get repeated as though they're facts. The shirt thing was a good example where Toomey just says this. It's always cited by the police advocates when they attack things like my book or anybody who defends Mumia. They say, oh, you know, he shot him four times on the ground. As he lay there, the witnesses said he stood over him and fired down at him four times, and one of the shots hit him in between the eyes and killed him. Well, the problem with that is, as Lynn Washington and I found in a test we did, we took the pictures of the crime scene, of the sort of the bloody spot where the officer had been lying on the sidewalk, and we sent them to a guy at NASA's JPL labs who's a photo analyst specialist. He's the one who takes the photos from the Cassini space probe, and which are taken in very dim light around Saturn, and he enhances them so that you can see those beautiful pictures of the moons of Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the same techniques and applied them to that sidewalk, and he said, there ain't no bullet marks in the sidewalk. Well, that's
right.
Critical because there also were no bullet holes in Faulkner. There was just the bullet hole in between the eyes. There were no other three bullets.
Right.
So if the witnesses who actually said they saw Mumia standing over Faulkner firing down at him point blank four times and missing three of them with high velocity bullets, where are the bullet holes? There are no bullet holes, and
right.
You can see there's another photo where the police investigators drew circles around wherever they found a fragment of a bullet, and there were some circles drawn on the sides of buildings. There were circles drawn like 10, 15 feet down the sidewalk where they found a fragment of a bullet, but there were no circles drawn for bullet holes around the near vicinity of the body where Faulkner had lain. And what we then did is we bought a gun that was exactly the same type of snub-nosed pistol that Mumia owned legally, and we brought that out to out in the woods up in central Pennsylvania with a big, huge, heavy chunk of sidewalk, old concrete to match the kind of sidewalk that, you know, aged hard concrete that the sidewalk was where this happened. And we, wearing military goggles to protect our eyes from fragments, we fired downward. Actually, I give credit to Lynn. He had the guts to do it. He fired downward at the sidewalk while I filmed it. And we then looked at the marks that were made by these bullets, and they were quite significant and hard to miss, even from a distance. So clearly, those witnesses were lying when they said what happened. So the eyewitnesses aren't even eyewitnesses.
Right.
In this case.
Yeah, it's incredible that these lies and what they did with Kenneth Freeman to keep him from talking is just, you know, it's outrageous. And I don't know why the Freeman stuff isn't used more. I'm so sorry that people aren't calling in.
Yeah, yeah. Please, we still have a few minutes, so if anybody has anything to ask about this case or ask anything else about Francis, we're at 888-874-4888. It may just be that we're doing such a good job of telling the story, there are no questions to ask Francis.
Perhaps. Perhaps. Well, I hope people will really – I think this is a wonderful – present for a kid who's graduating from high school.
You're listening to a interview conducted in March of 2014 on the PRN radio network, which no longer exists, by the way, with Dave Lindorf of TCBH, This Can't Be Happening, and Francis Goldman, who Francis was a very big mentor and publisher. She had all the connections to help many, many, many people, and journalists get their books published. I talked to her a couple times on the telephone. Frances, a great, great person. She passed away several years ago. Again, this was March 2014 on the PRN radio. All the dates and phone numbers, they're all they don't count. They don't count anymore, so. From the gold stuff, I'll play some more of that throughout the summer. We'll give John Grant a break. We'll play some of this. This is great stuff, great interview. Thank you for listening today. Have a good one.
The movie.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing this wonderful book. It's called Murder Incorporated, and it deals with every war the United States has ever been involved in, and all of them were wars of predation. No one invaded us. Nobody started the shooting. But it's why the book is called Murder Incorporated. And I can't wait for it to be finished so I can sell it to a big university press, because it's filled with incredible and there's maybe 30 pages of books they've read in order to produce this wonderful document.
Well, I'm amazed they can fit it all in one book. There's so many wars the U.S. has fought.
That's right.
Absolutely. I was trying to get my mother, who died last year, on a veteran's pension, because she was a Navy wave during World War II. And was entitled to her own pension, and very difficult to do. It takes a year, and she died before they processed the paperwork as a, you know, real crime.
Oh, dear.
But I do want to say that, you know, one of the things I learned when I was doing that was that you can only get a military pension if you served during a time of war. You can't just be in the service